Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Welcome back to Radio Islam's The Early Morning Breakfast Show on a Sunday. Well, Brother Faisal, as I said, is recovering after his trip to the Holy Lands for the Hajj. And may Allah accept his Hajj, as for the other Hujjaj as well. May Allah accept from them and Hajj Mabrur to them. Well, to fill in the time, inshallah, I'm not going to speak on tech issues today, but we will tell you about something that is making the headlines, and many people are either very afraid, very, you know, there's fear because obviously we don't understand everything that's going on with it, and also because there's so many people talking about so many different things that do affect it, that people are worried about what's going to happen with medical aid, especially with the National Health Insurance Bill coming into effect soon. And they say that medical aids as we know them will disappear by 2026 under the National Health Insurance Bill released. So Health Minister Zweli Mkhize unveiled the bill in Pretoria last week, and government will provide a package of comprehensive health services for free at private and public health facilities as part of its bid to you know, more equitable access to quality health care. Now, this has brought about a lot of, like I said, controversy, a lot of people speaking about it. Many people are saying, you know, with regards to the fact that we already have so many shortages, drug shortages, staff shortages, how is this all going to work? Doctors are saying that they are fed up because they're finding it very difficult already being understaffed, having to, you know, fill in for doctors who are not present or not there anymore because they don't have the money to pay. Government doesn't have the money to pay, so they are really working very long hours. And there's a lot of negativity seeming to be coming out of this. But what if we look at it from a positive point of view? What does this mean for many people? Well, if some of the issues that are seen as negative can be fixed, this will mean that people across the board will get medical treatment at private and health facility, public health facilities. They say for free, but there may be a cost in some cases, I'm assuming. We don't know yet how exactly all of this is going to work. But the important thing here is that there will be equitable access to quality health care. And I think that's the important thing that we should be focusing on. And for government, that would be the most important thing for them to focus on. With all the issues that we have in the medical sector and in many other sectors of government at the moment, obviously, if those things are not fixed, then there's not going to be quality or equitability in with regards to how it's going to pan out. So what are we supposed to expect in all of this? Well, this is basically what's going to happen, if I can understand it from what I've been reading. So it's based on the public health rationale that treating those with infectious disease will prevent this, you know, the spread of it. They've come up with this, and the reason for this is because they feel that many people in South Africa, and it's the truth, if you look, majority of people in South Africa cannot afford medical aid, which puts them at a very, very a big disadvantage compared to those who can. And many people who do have medical aid will tell you that it is a huge chunk of their salaries at the end of a month, making it very difficult for them to manage or budget every month. And medical aid is expensive. There are many rules that have to be followed. It doesn't always cover some of the medical issues that you may have. Sometimes it will only, you know, depending on the type of cover that you have with your medical aid, certain things don't get paid for. And sometimes it may, you know, people will say, but it's not cosmetic, you know, it's for definite health reasons, but the medical aid is not paying for this. What do I do? You know, those questions come up. And medical aids have to decide after, you know, much lengthy discussion between the doctors that are involved with the treatment as well as doctors working for the medical aid. They would decide whether they would pay for certain things that may be rejected, you know, normally. Then also they need to look at the fact that only certain things or certain chronic issues are covered, chronic diseases rather, are covered by medical aid. Some of them are not. Some of them are partially covered or to a certain extent, that kind of thing. So basically what's going to happen is the whole idea of the national health insurance is that everybody would get a chance to be covered for the important medical aspects that need to be covered. So what do we need to know about the NHI? One of the questions asked is, will you be able to have a comprehensive medical aid? Now, this question will come obviously from people who are already on medical aids. So the answer to that is no, because once the NHI has been fully implemented, your medical scheme will not be allowed to cover any health services that the NHI offers. You will have to use the NHI for those services. Your medical aid will only be able to provide you with complementary cover. In other words, services that the NHI does not cover. So, so you're looking at when would medical aid then disappear in their current form. According to the bill, the NHI needs to be up and running by 2026 through a system of mandatory payments. Many experts are arguing that the NHI will take much longer to take off. So, again, we'll have to be prepared for this kind of thing. We don't know how long it will be. The date set, or we should say the deadline, is 2026, which may seem like a long way off, almost 7 years. But, in all reality, if we understand that time really goes by very quickly, 6-7 years, we need to see whether the government can get the medical side of things. I mean, we need to look at hospitals. You need to look at, not just the hospital itself, but are hospitals ready to take on this kind of thing, because it's massive. Will there be enough resources? So with the resources, there's staffing. So will there be enough nurses? Will there be enough doctors? Then you've got to look at medication. We already have many, drugs that are not in stock. There's shortages of medication, that kind of thing. Will there be enough money to cover all of that? How is this money going to come through? There's been talk of additional taxes being put into play, that kind of thing. Then also we need to think about whether the equipment within all of the hospitals that would be associated with the NHI, well, that will be basically all our provincial hospitals, because most private hospitals already have all of this in place. But will the public hospitals be ready to take on this mammoth task? Then also, when you think about it, there's going to be a need for a database. And when you speak database, you're talking about IT. Will there be enough, people available to handle this kind of massive database that we're looking at? Because it's going to mean taking into account every citizen in South Africa. What about our foreign nationals that are coming in? How would this affect the system? Because we've got quite a few of that. I mean, that's a raging debate already. So all of these things need to come into, to be taken into consideration. And I'm sure that that's where some of the issues come up. A lot of them would be around, taxing money. And money obviously is the biggest issue, because without money, you're not going to be able to do any of the other things that are needed. You won't be able to get more resources, because obviously you have to pay for that. So people are also asking, what services will the NHI cover? So the bill doesn't specify what services the NHI would cover, but it does mention that there will be comprehensive healthcare services. Now, that's quite a generalized phrase. So the Benefits Advisory Committee that's going to be appointed by the Health Minister will decide on which services will be offered. And the bill says that these services will be available free, so there will be no co-payments. So we'll have to wait and see what they decide on, the Benefits Advisory Committee, what they are looking at, what they would deem to be comprehensive healthcare services. We can look at other countries and see what they offer, for Britain, for instance. But also there's been a lot of issue with regards to the, how the NHI works for them as well. Some people are happy with it, some aren't. I did an interview last week on Thursday with Emma Kinney, who is a psychologist, a broadcaster, and a motivational speaker, who is part of that, the NHI there in Britain. And she says that it has failed, especially within the health sector, has failed many of the citizens in Britain. Her father committed suicide 6 weeks ago. So obviously she understands how it all works and, being part of that. And for someone saying that, you know, the system there has failed. Now we're looking at a first world country, and here we are, you know, between second and third world, and how is this going to pan out for South Africa? So the NHI won't pay for treatment when it can demonstrate that there is no medical necessity that exists for the healthcare service in question, when the medicine or treatment is not included in the NHI's list of medicines, also known as the formulary, that's what medical aids use as well, and when no cost-effective intervention exists for the healthcare service. So like medical aids, there would be certain things that they will not pay for. And in this case, they're saying that if there's no medical necessity that exists within, you know, for the healthcare service in question, and also if it does not fall within the NHI's list of medicines known as the formulary. So if there is treatment that is required that falls within that list of medication, you will get it. If not, then obviously it's going to be from your pocket. Or I think if you belong to a medical aid, then obviously the medical aid will then have to complement. So obviously they would have to pay for that. So medical aid rulings will now have to also be looked at and probably be changed to fit in with the NHI. And according to the bill, the NHI will start to buy healthcare services for children, women, the elderly, and people with disabilities by 2022. So I'm trying to understand or see how this works. One of the other questions that comes up was, will you be able to go to a specialist directly? We know with medical aids, you have to go to a GP first and then referred to a specialist. In many medical aids, won't pay for a specialist visit if you haven't been approved and in some cases received an authorization number. So with regards to the NHI, no, if you do, the NHI won't pay, so you cannot go directly to a specialist. It's exactly as a medical aid. You'll have to be referred. You will have to register at an NHI-accredited primary healthcare facility, and each time you need healthcare, you will have to go to that facility. You will only be able to consult a specialist if the doctor or nurse at your primary healthcare facility deems it necessary to refer you to one. If you're traveling and you fall ill, you'll be able to go to an accredited facility in the area you're visiting. So basically, the rules are similar to those that medical aids are following. Now, when they're talking about primary healthcare facilities, I'm not sure if you remember, but some time back there was certain primary healthcare facilities that came up and that medical aids were covering. I'm trying to remember exactly what they were called. I don't see them anymore, so I'm assuming that they don't exist or probably didn't work out. A lot of them came up where, you know, groups of doctors would band together and you'd have your dentist, your x-ray department, your bloods, your GP, physiotherapy within one building, and they would then, you know, have medical aids cover the patients that came through for all of the services that they offered. And sometimes they would, like, you know, it was like almost like a one-stop shop if you were ill. Some of them have remained. I'm trying to think. There was one particular one that was really, really big, and medical aids were covering, but I don't see it in. I think it was called Prime Cure, if I remember clearly. I happen to have worked for 10 years in the medical aid industry, so this is going back a bit, but I remember it was Prime Cure, and they seem to have been doing pretty well at that time because, they were looking at the lower income groups, basically your mid-income groups, and people could go to them. The medical aids covered them, covered the cost of what they were doing, and they were quite reasonable if you were paying cash as well. It also, took the burden off the hospitals at that and the public hospitals in particular. But I haven't seen any of these in a while, and I know there used to be a very big one on Smith Street in Durban, which I must say I haven't seen it in that area, so I'm assuming that it no longer exists if you know of any of these healthcare facilities. And I know a couple others that did come up as well. Some I know are now, you know, practicing as just as a group, but as a private facility, not really as these facilities that had come up at that time. So what happens if you're an asylum seeker or an undocumented migrant? Now, obviously, these people also need to be getting medical care. you will only be able to access emergency medical services and services for notifiable conditions of public health concern, such as TB. HIV treatment is also likely to be available to asylum seekers and illegal immigrants, as HIV is infectious and it is in the best interest of the country to treat everyone who is infected with the virus to prevent its spread. The children of asylum seekers and migrants, however, will be entitled to basic health care services provided for in the Constitution. Now, that means that asylum seekers and undocumented migrants will only be treated for notifiable conditions of public health concern. So I'm assuming here that they're looking at specific, illnesses and things like that. If you're a registered refugee, you will be entitled to all services provided that you have registered for the NHI by using your refugee identity card. The NHI will also cater for foreign individual foreign national determined by the Home Affairs Minister after consultation with the Minister of Finance. So you can see that there's a lot of work still to be done with regards to this, and it would actually mean quite a few of the departments coming together to sort this out, because like I said, we've got quite a few foreign nationals, different categories in the country, and they would have to be looked at, and this is an added burden to our medical facilities as well. So who will pay for the NHI? And I think that is a question that everybody wants to know about. In short, taxpayers. That's you and I. If you pay tax, the bill says the money will be collected in accordance with social solidarity through payroll taxes for employees and employers, a surcharge on personal income tax, the reallocation of medical scheme tax credits and general taxes, money that Treasury currently allocates to provinces through the provincial equitable share and conditional grants will be shifted to the NHI fund. So this is an important thing that we need to be looking at. It would be good to hear what many of our doctors have to say about this, as well as the public in general. For those of us who are subscribed to a medical aid, it would be good to find out what our medical aides think about this as well. How do they feel about it? How are they going to restructure their rulings now with regards to this as well? With regards to prescribed minimum benefits, there's a list of 270 conditions, specified treatments that all medical aides must cover, and this includes emergency medical care and chronic illnesses. So will this now be covered by the NHI? What parts of it will it cover? Will there be exclusions, as we have with the medical aid? The changes to the PMB are one of the early signs that government is moving on recommendations made by the Competition Commission as part of its four-year investigation into the spiraling costs of private health care ahead of government's plans to begin buying services from the sector. The commission found that not only were consumers paying more for less when it came to private health care, but that the array of packages made it impossible for people to compare offerings between schemes. So standardizing a basic option ahead of the NHI will likely cut down confusion, the commission says in its preliminary report. It would not necessarily address high costs. So you see, this is one of the important things for me. I know that this is a very important thing. Many people join medical aids because of their chronic illnesses. And, we need to know how will NHI be covering this, what would happen with regards to this. Because right now we're seeing that within the healthcare sector, many of the people who cannot afford medical aid are covered by hospitals. Many a times they complain that, medicine's not available, and a host of other things that happen. So we'll have to wait and see, because we're definitely going to be affected big time by the NHI, especially seeing that money is coming from our taxes. So once again, our pockets, and many people, when our pockets are affected, we do seem to get very worried about that kind of thing, because it does affect our budget. And then obviously the way we live, our lifestyles are affected. So this becomes an issue for us. So inshallah, maybe that is something that we need to look at. A very important topic, the NHI, and how it would be affecting us in once it's been implemented, and also in the time that it will take to implement it. some of the things that I think are important is, one would be the chronic illness benefit. How would that be affected? The other is mental health. And like I was saying, you know, it's an important one because we're seeing if a country like Britain, if the mental health sector there is not being handled well, how will that be affecting us here in South Africa? Well, it's almost time for our interview with for our actuality lineup. And today's interview is an interesting one. We're talking about cybercrime, which is on the increase. It's a growing endemic globally, a crime in which the perpetrators are shrouded with a significant veil of anonymity and which affects both individuals and corporations in both the public and private sectors, respectively. With incidents on the rise, current South African laws do not effectively criminalize this kind of conduct. So this is according to Zakir Mohammed, director of the corporate investigation sector of the dispute resolution practice, and he works for the commercial law firm Cliff Decker Hoffmeyer. We're going to be speaking to him, inshallah, this morning with regards to this particular topic, cybercrime being on the increase. And, you know, when you think about cybercrime, what comes to mind a lot is the banking sector. That is where we see a lot of the cybercrime taking place. Also, if you're in business, then obviously you'll understand that as well. And many of us are using our phones, our smartphones, to do our banking, to make payment for almost anything today. And, it makes things so easy if you think about it. It's just, you know, taking out your phone, logging into your banking website and clicking buttons, and obviously your payments are being made. You can check on your balances, all sorts of things that can be done within the banking sector these days just on your phone. You know, it's something that we always speaking about with regards to the you know, how we actually work. So inshallah, we are going to take a quick break. Our guest is here, so maybe we're going to just speak on that topic right now. Brother Zakir Mohammed, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Very interesting topic, and as we're saying, cybercrime is on the increase. So what does the statistics show us with regards to the growth of cybercrime and the financial losses, especially with regards to banks?
So there's definitely, like you said, been a significant increase in the amount of cybercrime attacks that we've experienced in the last couple of years. The South African Banking Risk Information Center released their stats for 2018, and in those stats they found that there's been a 75% increase in cybercrime and digital banking platforms in 2018, mm-hmm. with a cumulative loss of 262 million rand. So it's quite significant. Right. We're talking about a lot of money. Certainly mm-hmm. in my practice, the amount of calls that I've received from clients who have lost money, I mean, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of rands. In some instances, it can be millions, depending on, you know, internet banking scams and the like.
Okay. Now, you know, what are the reasons for the growth in the increase? I mean, when you think about it, people... We all trust our banks every time there's some new feature that they have on the smart apps that they offer us. We're very quick to use it. So what would the reasons for the growth be? Is it because there's lack security? What is the reason?
So there's several reasons that come into play. I think the one reason I must state before I get into the others is mm-hmm. Cybercrime is big business for cyber criminals, and this is because of a veil of anonymity with this kind of criminal. You don't know where the attack is coming from. You can't foresee it. It's not physical in nature, but it's done over an electronic platform. Mm-hmm. Then the second and the biggest reason is there's a lot of internet users out there, and the internet users are growing on a daily basis. I mean, I think you mentioned it, how attached we are to our cell phones and how convenient it is for us to do so mm-hmm. much using our cell phones. I mean, aside from banking, we can order our groceries online. There's so much. We communicate online. Nowadays, we don't even pick up the phone and talk to one another. We communicate via WhatsApp. So there's a lot of internet users out there. But a lot of people don't understand the technology that we're using and the risks that we're using. So it's also user knowledge of mm-hmm. what the particular risks are. And people are not being careful when they're dealing with internet banking transactions. And also when they're clicking on attachments, the SMSs they receive, or if they receive emails, and these are called phishing emails, clicking on links to suspicious mm-hmm. emails. You know, it's that kind of user activity that ultimately results in these kinds of breaches. So on the one hand, the rise is because there's a lot of internet users, but it's also because there's a lack of knowledge and cybersecurity controls in a lot of businesses as well.
Mm-hmm. So what are the inherent risks of cybercrime, not only to individuals, but more importantly to businesses as well?
So obviously for individuals, it's a loss of money, and in those instances, it can be significant sums of cash, which could be detrimental to any individual. For organizations, there's several. Obviously, the financial loss is one, and that financial loss is not just the loss of the money being victim of the particular cybercrime, but then it's the cost involved in trying to investigate that particular incident, trying to deal with what needs to be done to manage the situation and calling in the relevant experts, etc. And then there's also the reputational impact that can be had on the particular business. Mm. For example, there might be a loss of client confidence in the business's ability to maintain confidential information, and this is quite relevant when it comes to a particular data breach. So for a business, I mean, this kind of attack can result in a lot of damage to the reputation of the particular business.
But, you know, when you think about it now, you've given us a whole range of reasons why this is happening. But banks are now saying that they would prefer to have their clients, interact via these platforms rather than coming into a physical bank environment. So when this happens now, do we here in South Africa have legislative measures in place to address this growing phenomenon? And is our data protected, and what does it all entail?
So we do have legislation at the moment in South Africa that deals with cybercrime, but at the moment our legislation is a bit silo-based. So we've got the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act, and that is a piece of legislation that has a few provisions that deal with cybercrime. There's just about four provisions, and this legislation was enacted some time ago, so it's a little bit outdated. We've also got the Criminal Procedure Act, which is the act that is used to investigate cybercrime. We've got the and this name is a bit long, the regulation of interception of communications and provision of communication-related information act. A lot of us know this as RICA. And this is a piece of legislation that also assists with the investigation of cybercrime. It deals with the unlawful interception of emails and the like. And then we've also got the Protection of Personal Information Act, and that is our key piece of data privacy legislation, or the protection of people's personal data. Now, that piece of legislation is currently being enacted, and we're waiting for many of its provisions to come into effect. So as you can see, there's a few pieces of legislation. So we don't have one comprehensive piece of legislation at this stage that completely addresses cybercrime. However, we do have the Cybercrime Bill, which we're waiting for it to be tabled and passed by Parliament. And this bill has been a bill for the last number of years. And once it becomes law, it will be a comprehensive piece of legislation that will address cybercrime, the investigation of cybercrime, etc. So hopefully we are moving in the right direction. But at the moment, I don't think our cybersecurity laws are sufficiently strong enough to deal with this kind of scourge. But the one thing that I must mention... So the one thing I must mention is, when it comes to a crime like cybercrime, you've got the laws, etc., and the laws are particularly important. But because there's a veil of anonymity around this particular crime, you must remember that any piece of legislation that is criminal in nature is geared towards prosecuting someone for it. Now, when you've got cybercrime, if you don't know who the perpetrator of the crime is, who do you prosecute? So to deal with the scourge of cybercrime, on the one hand, we must have this kind of legislation to act as a deterrent and to help our prosecuting authorities prosecute. But I think the most important thing that I'll stress is obviously user authority and user knowledge. For all of us taking the initiative to understand the platforms that we're using on the electronic front.
All right, talking about that, are there precautions that businesses and individuals can take to mitigate the potential risk of becoming a victim of cybercrime?
Yes, there's quite a lot. So I'm going to go through the list. I'll start off with individuals, because I think that boils down to user behavior, both in your personal capacity as well as in your businesses as well. I think when you're dealing with the internet, always be cautious, be vigilant in what you're doing, educate yourself about the risks. And on the same side, if you're an organization, educate your employees on the various risks and scams that are doing the rounds. So that's quite important. Be wary of password sharing. A lot of us tend to be very lax when we come to our passwords. Don't use easy and simple passwords that anybody can detect. So don't use a password of your favorite pet, of the first car you drove, etc. Use something that's going to be very difficult to detect. They say that one of the best passwords to use should be between 6 to 10 characters long. It should have a capital letter, it should have some numbers in there, it should also have some characters in there, which makes it very difficult for cyber criminals to detect. So be wary of password, simple passwords. Also, be careful of shoulder spying. I always use this as an example. A lot of us, when we've flown somewhere, you may have seen someone working on their laptop in a plane. Now, when you're sitting on a plane, you're obviously sitting very close to one another, so the person behind you or next to you can see what you're doing. So be careful of that. There's actually a screen that you can buy so that the person next to you can't see what you're doing on your laptop, but you obviously can see what you're doing. When it comes to emails, if you're receiving emails and it's an email from someone that you don't know, be very vigilant. Look at the header of an email. So, for example, if you know that you generally communicate with me, zakir@cdh.com, if that's my normal email address, and all of a sudden you receive an email that says zakircdh@gmail.com. Now, be wary of something like that, because that could be a hacker trying to elicit some information from you. And also look at the content of the email. Sometimes with email scams, you might find that you need to pay for a particular service that you've done. And let's say you need to pay an amount of 100,000 rand, and all of a sudden you receive an email that says, you know what, before you make the payment, we've changed our banking details, so please can you pay it into the following banking detail. What you then need to do is verify the banking detail by phoning the person that you usually deal with. Don't use the phone number that you receive in that particular email, but use the phone number that you normally communicate with that person with, or go onto the internet and find the relevant contact details independently of that email. So taking that kind of precaution, I think for businesses should have cybersecurity controls in place, so the relevant software, etc., to detect this kind of activity. Businesses can also have cyber risk insurance cover, which is becoming quite a big thing. I said verify banking details before making a payment. Also beware of when you use Wi-Fi hotspots. A lot of us love free things. I'm also one of those people that do. And we love free Wi-Fi wherever we go. But be careful, because what can also happen is sometimes hackers set up their own Wi-Fi hotspots at public points so that they can then access your computer system. So, for example, if you're at the airport, and the normal airport Wi-Fi would be a free airport Wi-Fi _1, and that's the legitimate one. What a hacker might do is they might set up a Wi-Fi network that says free airport Wi-Fi _2 or something to that effect. So you might mislead yourself into thinking that it's, you know, a legitimate network, but then you end up entering into the hacker's network. So be wary of that. And I think just be vigilant, and also don't, a lot of us are guilty of just also clicking on SMS links or clicking on links in emails because we promised a free trip or we promised to win some money, etc. And that's usually when people get fall victim to phishing scams. So be wary of clicking on links that you don't know the source of where that email is coming from. You know, I can use one example of something that I received. I received an email from my bank a few months ago. Because they were implementing a new system, right? And over the course of the last 2 years, I'd received my statement, so I more or less knew they would address me as Dear Zakir Muhammad. So I knew that that's always how my email started, etc. And then off the bat, I received an email and it said, "Dear ZA Muhammad." So I noticed that particular difference, and that was a red flag that made me think, okay, let me not click on anything, because the email wanted me to check an attachment, so I didn't. What I did do is I went onto the internet, I went to my bank's website, found the phone number, and then I phoned them and I said, "I received this email. Is this an email that came from the bank, etc.? And what is this about? And can you please explain it to me, because I'm not going to click on the link until I can verify that this is a legitimate email." I also knew that this was not an email address that I normally received emails from my bank from, and the bank basically told me that no, that there was nothing that came from the bank, etc. So it's taking that kind of step and just being vigilant and verifying things that you receive. Also take note of email content. You know, sometimes a red flag could be the grammar and the spelling that is used in a particular email, especially when it comes to these scams. But sometimes when I deal with these cases and I look at the evidence that that our clients have, or when we assess their system, sometimes I can see the red flags and you can see the spelling errors, or you can see a change in phone number. So it's just taking that level of precaution.
So it's just basically people having to be more vigilant, just being aware that, you know, if your bank doesn't usually ask you for your PIN or things like that, and if you do get things, you know, these kinds of emails, then obviously just pick up the phone and call the bank rather than, you know, go ahead and respond to those emails and things like that, or even call sometimes. You get people 100%. Calling you, you know. Okay, so as society, sorry, carry on.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I just wanted to say that on the PIN side, your bank will never phone you and ask you for your PIN or password, nor will they email you to do that, because that's obviously quite sensitive information, and that's geared towards your security. So also be careful of phone calls that you receive. We all, or most of us, receive calls every day from different organizations trying to sell our stuff, etc. So just be wary of those calls, because sometimes you're very busy and you receive a call and someone says, "I'm calling you from your bank," and they're very smart in these particular calls in eliciting information from you. So be very careful of sharing your personal information on those particular calls, because you don't know where the call is coming from, and always the call will start off and the person will know your name. So they'll say, "Hi, how are you?" So I always get those calls, and I immediately know it's one of those calls that I don't want. When they're like, "Hi, can I please speak to Zaki Muhammad?" And I'm like, "Yes, speaking. How are you today, sir?" I'm like, "I'm very well, thanks, and you?" And then they'll start saying, "We're calling you from our bank. We just want to verify that you're the right person. Can you please provide us with your ID number? Can you please provide us with your cell number?" Now, be very careful of that, because you don't know who the person on the other end of the line is. But they're starting to elicit your personal information. So rather maybe take down their contact details, ask them if they are phoning from your bank, and then you phone your bank independently. You know, just be careful of sharing information through those calls as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, older people generally get caught up in this kind of thing, because they don't really, are not very au fait with the internet a lot of the times, and they tend to give out the information because they're trusting. So obviously, I think a lot of the times they are very much at risk, and especially, you know, if you don't understand what is happening with all the changes that have taken place and you're used to the old conventional way of banking, this does pose a problem for older people.
Yeah.
As society, we also are becoming very comfortable with phrases like the deep web, the dark web, hackers, ethical hacking, that kind of thing. But does that give a false kind of security to the the Joe Soap, the average person, because we start believing that cyber criminals will not really worry about the information on your computer, cell phones, and other devices? Generally, like I'm saying, people that are not in the know don't really think about these things.
100%. I think we've become so desensitized to this kind of thing, because we hear about it all the time, we read about it all the time, and the only time that it really hits us or it really affects us is when we've actually found out that we've been the victim of a particular scam. But aside from that, there is a bit of complacency on our front to make sure that we educate ourselves, or that we take this kind of issue seriously, because at the end of the day, we are very comfortable in our use of technology and mobile phones, but we're not careful about how we're using this technology. Now, obviously, obviously technology has made our lives incredibly easy. It's made things simple for us in many respects, and that's the direction we're moving in, and it is a positive direction, but we also need to be vigilant and careful in how we're using the technology to make our lives easier, because you don't want to find yourself, you know, the victim of identity theft or the victim of an internet banking fraud or whatever the case may be. So I agree with you, and I mean, I can use one example of what the mindset mm-hmm. of some people may be out there. It's a case that I dealt with last year, and I had a client phone, and they had lost 800,000 rand. And she asked for some advice, and I gave her some advice on the steps that she can take, etc. And one of the things she mentioned to me on the call, she said that, you know, this is the third time that we lost some money through this, you know, like preparing the deposit into the wrong banking account. And,
wow.
You know, someone told me that, you know, it's just one of those things that we just have to accept at the end of the day as a reality that we face, and unfortunately we just have to lose the money. And then I told her that, no, that's not the way you need to think about it, because you can't just accept it as that, because just by that sentence alone, she told me a few things. The one thing is that if this was the third time that they were hit with this kind of fraud, it meant that their systems were compromised. So what she needed mm-hmm. to do was actually beef up their systems and get the cybersecurity controls in place. Also, the mindset cannot be that this is something that we must accept and make provision for it in our books of account. You know, for businesses to say, okay, fine, we're going to have a provision for cybercrime losses of X amount. That cannot be the mindset. The mindset has to be, we need to take the steps to make sure that we can mitigate this risk affecting us and our businesses. So we need to take what steps we can do. And I mean, another example is in our organization, one of the things we've implemented is, you know, periodic training. Our IT department is quite good at sending us emails, you know, every 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Just a short training video just to alert us of a particular scam. Then whenever there's a new phishing scam that's doing the rounds, we get an email. And the importance of that is to remind us that, listen, this is still happening. And cyber criminals, this is their business. This is what they do every day. So they're going to find new ways to perpetrate this kind of crime. And mm-hmm. it's important mm-hmm. for us to be up to speed with the new kind of schemes that they come up with.
Absolutely. So, when, you know, somebody has been in a situation like this, like the lady you spoke about, what happens? Do they, you know, what is the procedure for them, or anybody for that matter? I mean, if I found that I had my bank account hacked, or something went wrong and I see a lot of money has gone out, what would I have to do? Do I come straight to a lawyer? Do I go to my bank? What would the process be for the layperson?
So I think there's quite a few important things to do, and in that respect, time is of the essence. So do not delay in acting, especially when it mm-hmm. comes to a cybercrime thing. But also be smart about what you do and how you do it. So if you've been a victim, or you find that you've lost a lot of money out of your bank account, phone your bank immediately as soon as possible, because if you delay phoning your bank, it makes the recovery of that money so much more difficult. And what I mean by this, I can use two examples. We had a case where a particular client of ours, he received a phone call. There was some request to change his SIM card or whatever the case may be, which was a strange call for him to receive. And then he also received a call from his bank supposedly saying that, you know, that there's some activity noticed on the account or whatever, and can you please click on a number on his phone. But what was basically happening is they were trying to basically get him to authorize an irregular payment. So the call mm-hmm. that he received was from a fraudster. So he put the phone down, and then he phoned the bank himself, using the bank's legitimate number from the internet. And
yes.
He told the bank, I received this call from you, and I just want to verify if this is a call from you. And he was then basically told that, no, but we can actually see in your account that an amount of 420,000 has just been transferred into another bank account. He said, I did not authorize that, so please stop it immediately. So he acted very quickly, and in that case, they were able to recover the money. But then we've got other cases where, you know, the money, it's been discovered that money's been transferred to a wrong bank account, the money's been missing from an account, but people have delayed in acting. But then the money's already been transferred into another bank account, and from there, it's been withdrawn, and then the money's lost, and then it's very difficult to recover the money. So notify the bank immediately. If you're not sure of what to do, then yes, definitely call the experts in. It helps to get that advice immediately, because there's a lot of factors come into play. There isn't a set formula on how to handle this thing, but I always tell everyone that when you act, understand what it is that you're doing and what you're trying to achieve from that. So the first thing is mitigate any further loss.
Yes.
So if you're an organization and you've been hit with a cybercrime attack, call the experts in immediately so that they can guide you through that particular process. And those experts would be a mix of legal experts. It would be IT forensic specialists as well, because they can come in and they can secure your systems immediately. The legal guys can come in and assist you with what you can possibly do from a legal side. So they can assist you with registering a criminal case. They can assist you in advising on what your possible civil recovery options could be, and that would be dependent on the circumstances of each case, because each case is going to be different. So I would say act very quickly and make sure that you get good advice at the outset to make sure that you don't lose any evidence that might be relevant for any ensuing legal process, that you don't lose any further funds, etc.
Okay. Brother Zakir, Jazakallah Khair for being with us and giving us all those excellent bits of information that I think people definitely need, because as we said, this is something that's increasing as the days go by, and it's something that I think will not stop, because people will always be finding ways to better them, their ways of getting to people to get money out of people. So we appreciate this. Thanks for making the time, and have a good week ahead. Assalamu alaikum.
You too. Wa alaikum salam.
Shukran. Well, there you have it, some excellent advice on how to protect yourself from, hackers and all sorts of other people that try to get money out of your bank accounts, or even, any other platform that you may be accessing via your phones or your laptops. While it's time for the news, inshallah, in a few minutes, I'll be back with our financial slot thereafter.